EJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, May 16, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week, we share a clip from the latest episode of the Courage My Friends podcast series. In this episode, host Rush Badu sat down with visiting professor and dean of the Faculty of Agriculture and Veterinary Medicine at Gaza's Al-Azhar University, Dr. Ahmed Abu Shaban. The two discussed the weaponization of already fragile food systems in Gaza, the acceleration of the climate crisis through conflict, and Palestinian resilience under occupation. Here is a small clip from that conversation. Take a listen.
Ahmed, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So could you tell us about your work?
Actually, I'm associate professor in natural resources management, and my research focuses on mainly food system in post-conflict zone. My main focus is on Palestine, in Gaza Strip in particular. Considering all factors affecting food system in Palestine, this is including climate change, as it is a major issue in Palestine in general, but in Gaza Strip in particular, but also the implication of Israeli occupation and settler colonialism project on the food system, and also investigation of the food-related policies, either just imposed by the Israeli occupation, but also internal food policies, and how actually we can just work on resilient food system in Palestine, and what kind of community coping mechanism were taken actually to reduce the negative implication of the food crisis in Palestine.
You recently delivered the closing presentation at the George Brown College Labor Fair in Toronto, and the session began with a land acknowledgement, which is now common in Canada. What does the land acknowledgement mean to you as a Palestinian?
You know, as a Palestinian, I'm currently now displaced in Canada. It was really something very interesting for me to know about land acknowledgement, because land acknowledgement actually is reflecting a very similar story of what's going on right now in Palestine about indigenous people, people of this land. I mean, the land property was taken from them by the new settlers, and this is really a very good exercise to acknowledge their right. Although actually this is not reflecting any action. It's like just saying to the people, okay, sorry, we took your land and we acknowledge that it is your land, but your land will not be actually given back to you. For me, I believe this is a very good lesson for the whole humanity, that we should not allow this to happen again. And if we do not take at least a lesson out of that, that the right of the original or the indigenous people of a certain land should be respected, and the crisis of taking land from the indigenous people, I mean, the right should be protected. And as a humanity here, regardless if you are talking about Canada or whatever international community, we should also all stand for the Palestinian, because this is something that we should learn from the history. And the land acknowledgement is standing there to remind us and also to give us a very good lesson that as a humanity, we should all work against any attempt to take those people out of their land and to protect their right to live over their land. And therefore, I believe this is something good only if we learn the lesson out of it. But if we don't learn the lesson out of this acknowledgement, I think it has no significant meaning.
Right. It becomes bereft of meaning. Yeah. And you also started your talk by speaking on the meaning of Palestinian identity. What does it mean to be Palestinian?
Yeah, this is really a very good question, because sometimes it is meant to reflect kind of a religious meaning of Palestinian. So usually I say, you know, my name is Ahmed. I am Muslim. I am Palestinian. But Jesus Christ actually was Palestinian. And we have Palestinian Jewish. What does it mean to be Palestinian? This is the indigenous people of Palestine, the people who were there. Now, if you think about the new settlers who came after what happened in Europe, when the Jewish were disadvantaged, they actually came to Palestine, and Palestine provided them with the protection and shelter, whatever food of this land was shared. And this actually differentiates between the original people of Palestine, who actually coming from all religions. So being a Palestinian does not mean you are against Jewish or you are against Christian. It's not a religion. It's a nationality. Like when you talk about the indigenous people here in Canada, indigenous people are the original people of this land. So this is what is meant by being Palestinian. Like, it's the original people of this land. They are Palestinian.
So the situation facing Palestinians, as the situation facing indigenous peoples here, is fundamentally about land and sovereignty.
Yeah, I believe this is actually, I don't like to say that there is any positive thing about what's going on in Palestine right now or in Gaza. Mm. But if we think of any good thing about it, it just brought the attention to the area or what's going on to the area. Because all the atrocities that we are seeing right now and all the aggression that is practiced against the Palestinian people, the genocide against the Palestinian people, is maybe the most massive that we experience right now. Mm-hmm. But it's not new. It's a long story. And this is what I usually try to reflect even through my research, that the Israeli policy to challenge the Palestinian people to access their land, to practice their activities, to produce food, that is not actually started only after the 7th of October. It has a long history, taking different forms of challenging the Palestinian people. I mean, in Gaza, we can talk about different forms of restricting access to land to practice farming activities. One third of our arable land in Gaza is taken long before the 7th of October, and it is called access restricted area, where farmers actually, they own the land, but they cannot access the land. And they have even different regulations. A certain portion of their land they can access, but they have a very limited model of practices that is allowed there. This is not only for land, but also for the sea. Fishing area is restricted by the Israeli occupation in Gaza. So this is in Gaza, but also in West Bank. So it is part of a strategy, a long-term strategy by the Israeli occupation to challenge all means of life for the Palestinian. One of the main challenges is to create kind of a fragile food system where people cannot actually independently practice food production, and land and food sovereignty here is an issue, because people actually cannot have good access to their land, but also limitation. Because when you think about food system in Gaza, either it is locally produced from our farms or it is imported through the borders. Now come to the food that is produced locally, you have a limited access to the land, you have a limited access to water, you have also a limited access to inputs. Input supply is coming only through the borders, and it is restricted by or limited by the Israelis. Now, when you think about what is imported as food before the 7th of October, it was controlled by the Israelis, and the amount of food that was allowed to come inside Gaza was controlled before. Now, this is long-term strategy, with even a long-term aggression, because this is not the first war against Gaza, destruction of farm assets and farming sector was practiced long before the 7th of October. We have five wars before, and even the period between the wars, the Israelis usually would come inside Palestinian land and destroy farm assets. But also, it's a long-term strategy to challenge the food system and to create kind of a fragile food system in Gaza, that when they decide, as what happened during this war, now we are going to use food as a weapon, they were successful. One very good question about this, why actually the people inside Gaza were facing food insecurity only 5 days after the ongoing genocide started? Because before that, their food system was controlled by the Israelis. Their land was controlled by the Israelis. Their agricultural inputs is challenged by the Israelis. This is one of the major issues in Gaza. It is a long-term control of all means of life, but one of the main sectors that were controlled by the Israelis were the food system, with a very clear intention that they would like to control the food of the Palestinian people inside Gaza. But by the way, they are doing even the same thing right now in West Bank. Mm-hmm. So even long before the 7th of October, the intention to use food as a weapon and to control the natural resources. But this is also the same thing for all other sectors. Like for the education sector, it's the same thing. For the health sector, it is the same thing. For the environmental sector, it's the same thing. Always they have the strategy to challenge all means of life for the Palestinian people, to create a situation that the people would just select, okay, we cannot live like this and we should leave this land.
Talking about land, just to give some more context to this, the land that the Palestinian people are on today is very different from the Palestine of pre-1948, the Nakba, when they were violently displaced from the land. Could you give sort of a brief overview of how historic Palestine has transitioned into the Palestine that we see today, Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem?
Before 1948, Palestine was the whole historical Palestine. The settlers who are coming from outside Palestine was actually representing less than 5% of the historical Palestine. As I said, it is a very long story with a very strategic settler colonialism project utilizing wide range of strategies to decline historical Palestine or the territories where the Palestinians live. And now we are just talking about less than 20% of the whole historical Palestine, where the Palestinians, with a very high population density, and they are just pushing the Palestinian people into smaller pieces of land that are controlled by the Israeli occupation from all sides. Yeah, this is in West Bank and in Gaza Strip. Gaza Strip used to be one piece of land, like 365 kilometers of land, but where you have around 2.2 million people live in this piece of land. And it is known internationally as the biggest open-air prison in the world, where actually people live under siege now for more than 17 years, with, of course, implication of the siege on the livelihood of the people, very high rate of poverty, even long before the ongoing genocide in Gaza, very high level of unemployment, very limited infrastructure, very limited public services. But also in the West Bank, where you have 3.2 million live in around 5,550 square kilometers, which is disconnected geographically, 227 disconnected districts, where you would like to move from one town to another town, you should go through Israeli checkpoints where different forms of dehumanization of Palestinians are practiced. So this West Bank even is categorized into three categories based on this Oslo agreement that was supposed actually to end with a Palestinian independent state on only around 32% of the historical Palestine. But according to that agreement, which was a temporary agreement till we reach a final agreement that has never been reached, the Israelis keep talking about peace process, but without result, but they keep taking more and more land to establish more and more illegal settlements. Now, West Bank, where we have 18%, which is according to the agreement, is supposed to be controlled by the Palestinian Authority, it's not practically controlled by the Palestinian Authority because the Israeli occupation, every day they invade these territories and even practice aggression, demolish houses, demolish infrastructure. You have the Area B where you have 21% of the West Bank is a joint control between the Israeli Authority and the Palestinian Authority. But again, in practice, it's not the case because the Israelis do not allow the Palestinians to control anything. And you have around 61%, which is Area C in West Bank, which is whatever small piece or portion of historical Palestine, which is supposed to, in a temporary base, to be controlled by the Israeli Authority till the peace agreement reach kind of a final agreement for a Palestinian independent state. The Israelis keep taking more and more of this land to establish more and more illegal settlements. So we have there around 121 illegal settlements. And when we talk about illegal settlements, we are talking about internationally acknowledged as illegal settlements. This is not a Palestinian just definition of illegal settlements. And you have around 102 outposts where you have around 500,000 Israeli settlers. They live in these illegal settlements on the Palestinian land that is based on Oslo Agreement that actually signed by the Israelis, considering that this is a Palestinian land. And according to the international law, those 500,000 Israeli settlers live on a Palestinian land that is actually internationally acknowledged as a Palestinian land. So this is kind of a reflection of the current situation, reflection of actually the Israelis utilizing, as I said, different strategies, one of them even the political peace talks ongoing for maybe 30 years without reaching any results. But the Israelis never stopped to take more and more land, to establish more and more illegal settlements. And now even their intention is outspoken by their politicians, talking about, we don't want a Palestinian independent state. We want actually to destroy any potential for independent Palestinian state in the future. And therefore, in a very systematic way, when they establish their illegal settlements on a Palestinian land, they try to create a fact on the ground that actually enhanced this disconnection between the Palestinian territories, that in future, we cannot actually have one full piece of land where we can establish our independent Palestinian state. I mean, the problem for them actually is the demographic one, because they have been trying for maybe 80 years now to push the Palestinian people out of their land. They have been trying several things, but still you have 3.2 million Palestinian on West Bank with all the challenges that they have. And you have around 2.2 million Palestinian in Gaza Strip. And this is for them like, okay, we push them on a smaller piece of land. We create a very tough living condition for them, but the people, they still would like to stay on their land. And now what's all the aggression, what we observe now, the genocide, even the utilization of food as a weapon, using even starvation as a weapon, this is actually a mean how they wish to solve this demographic problem. They want to get the people out of their country, out of their land. And this is what they are trying right now to do through the aggression on the ground.
And this aggression is also seen within narratives about Palestinian heritage and identity. I mean, it has been 18 months since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel and the start of the most recent, there have been many, as you say, but the most recent assault on Gaza by Israel, which again is intensifying since the ending of the last ceasefire. Could you speak more to sort of the dominant narratives, particularly in mainstream media, that have sought to negate Palestinian history and identity? Because I find Palestinian scholars, people speaking about Palestinian culture and history and stories and attachment to land, they are also forced to provide a counter-narrative to the dominant narrative that is also an anti-Palestinian narrative.
This is really important, because now the narrative that they are trying actually to promote, like everything has started after the 7th of October. By the way, me myself, I am not supporter of what happened in the 7th of October. I'm not justifying that. But what I say that level of depression of the Palestinian community could lead to such action. I'm not talking about the political decision that was taken behind this, but I'm talking about even those young people, as someone who's 100% sure they will lose their life to do such action. But they still decided to do that. For me, I never agree on that. I never support that. But we need to understand, because it's always a good thing to ask a question. Why do you think such number of young people decided to go for such action while they are still young people and they still have a potential future? Because actually the life of the Palestinian became worthless because of the sustainable aggression, sustainable policies, stressing policies by the Israeli occupation on the Palestinian in Gaza Strip and in the West Bank created that situation that has exploded. And I believe that this mentality of keeping people under pressure will lead to no peace will be obtained. And the only thing we need to think about, we need to understand that the Palestinian cause is mainly people under occupation, that their basic rights were denied by the Israeli occupation, putting them under pressure and continuous pressure. Now the whole world is talking about what happened during the 7th of October and the Israeli retaliation on this, that of course can never justify the level of aggression, because even if you just consider the number of people who were killed from both sides, it's obvious that the Palestinians are weak, the Palestinians are victims, and all those innocent people who were killed. I mean, vast majority of the people who were killed, who lost their houses, who lost their life, who lost their future, they have nothing to do with Hamas. They have nothing to do with what happened on the 7th of October. They are disadvantaged simply because they are Palestinian. And I believe what's going on has nothing even to do with the 7th of October. It is part of the continuous, ongoing Israeli policies to push the people out of their land. Their interest is the land, but without the people.
That was a clip from the latest episode of the Courage My Friends series featuring host Resh Badu and guest Dr. Ahmed Abu Shaban. To listen to the full episode, please tune in to our sister podcast, Needs No Introduction, home of the Courage My Friends podcast series. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, I'll turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, Prime Minister Mark Carney unveiled his new cabinet on Tuesday. As promised, this cabinet did have gender parity between men and women. Additionally, Carney brought back one ministry that was cut from his previous cabinet, the Ministry of Women, Gender Equality and Youth. Carney also appointed the first Indigenous-led person to lead the Ministry of Indigenous Services, Quebec MP Mandy Gulmasti. However, there were some criticisms of the makeup of Carney's new cabinet. Carney had promised a smaller cabinet size as compared to that of his predecessor Justin Trudeau, who had 38 ministers. Carney did appoint 28 ministers to his cabinet, but also handed out 10 secretaries of state positions to MPs who will essentially serve as junior ministers in charge of specialized areas like sports. Also in national news, after appointing his new cabinet, Carney's first official act was to announce a new middle-class tax cut. Labor leaders and income inequality advocates criticized the move, however, saying that the cut will give a small amount of support to one group while forcing the government to cut services used by everyone. The nonprofit organization Canadians for Tax Fairness called on Carney to raise taxes on the richest Canadians to make up for the funding deficit that this middle-class tax cut will create. According to Canadians for Tax Fairness, only those making around $57,000 a year or more would benefit from the tax cut. Meanwhile, it will cost the government nearly $27 billion in revenue over 5 years. This week in health news, National Nurses Week is being recognized this week from May 12th to the 18th. Rabble columnist Kathy Crow is an active street nurse with decades of experience, and in her column Recognizing Nurses Week, she paid tribute to all the women who have contributed to the healthcare system throughout Canada's history. Some of those women include Bernice Redmond, who was the first Black Canadian nurse to practice in public health. Redmond faced racism throughout her career and broke barriers for people of color working in healthcare. There was also Susan Bailey, head nurse at Toronto's Emigrant Hospital in the late 19th century, where she cared for Irish immigrants who had contracted typhus. Crow writes that for those who want to continue to celebrate National Nurses Week, the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions is holding a live event on Facebook on May 21st at 12 p.m. Eastern. Also this week, the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, in the most recent op-ed on Rabble, is sharing how everyone can get involved in the fight to protect reproductive rights in Canada. The Conservative Party continues to represent an ongoing threat to the future of reproductive rights in Canada, but while they lost the recent federal election, access to reproductive care, like abortions, remains uneven throughout the country. One of the most important ways to get involved is to get educated, and there are great resources out there for those who want to learn more about reproductive justice in Canada, including podcasts like Let's Talk Abortion and the Abortion Podcast. For more information, check out the full article on Rabble.ca today. And finally, May 15th marked the 77th anniversary of the Nakba. The Nakba commemorates the day in 1948 where Palestinians were evicted from their homes by Israelis and that their land was stolen. Rabble founder Judy Rebick said that a broad coalition of activists is required to combat the ongoing oppression and violence that Palestinians continue to face at the hands of the Jewish supremacist government in Israel. Since the October 7, 2023 terrorist attack by Hamas against Israel, the Israeli government has retaliated ruthlessly against the civilian Palestinian population, especially in Gaza. It is estimated that over 50,000 civilians have been killed in Gaza since October 7th, and currently Israel is engaged in a blockade of the territory and preventing all food and water from entering. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.